At the ExxonMobil K Street office, Dan Nelson and his colleagues worked the phones to track what might emerge in the energy policy sections of the annual State of the Union. But in the case of the Addicted to Oil speech in 2006, they failed to intervene successfully. Drafts of the president's address were very closely held. They learned that a push toward ethanol would receive heavy play, but they received no preview of the language repudiating oil and gas. Inside the White House that winter, economists and National Security Council senior directors who believed that global oil markets were liquid and interdependent, and who believed that independence from oil imports was an unnecessary and illusory goal, failed, too, to persuade the Bush speechwriters to remove the talk's reference to ending Middle East dependency. They argued about the liquidity of the global oil market, and how a particular importing nation could determine which barrel of oil was foreign versus domestic. But if one of the White House economists raised a question challenging the call for energy independence, the president's politically attuned speechwriters would respond, "The president has seen this language in 10 previous drafts and obviously likes it. Do you really want to get in his way?" After the speech was delivered, Saudi officials and diplomats from other oil producers aligned with the United States, who felt they had been insulted, protested formally to the White House. "It upset the Saudis," the senior official recalled. Dimash followed that speech. In Irving, Rex Tillerson sided with the Saudis. He believed, as did ExxonMobil's management committee, that energy independence is not attainable, not any time in the foreseeable future, and that its pursuit was not desirable because it would set the United States on misguided courses that might raise the cost of energy in the American economy, destroy jobs, and disrupt trade alliances around the world. As for Middle Eastern oil in particular, it represented less than a quarter of the American oil imports, and the percentage seemed likely to decline in the future as African, Canadian, and other sources of supply grew. Most Middle Eastern oil went to Asia, and more would head east in the future. What specifically would be the benefits of American energy independence? For each argument put forth by alternative energy and import independence advocates, ExxonMobil's executives and lobbyists developed a response, which they delivered, particularly in the period that followed the Addicted to Oil Declaration, in their own speeches at think tanks and universities and economic forums, and on PowerPoint slides that ExxonMobil lobbyists handed out on Capitol Hill. These arguments addressed the main tenets of the import independence advocates. Energy independence would strengthen the American economy by reducing costly oil imports and thereby dramatically improving the country's trade and balance of payment deficits, about half of which were due to oil imports. But there was no proven or obvious correlation between a nation's trade balances and its per capita income or gross domestic product growth, ExxonMobil's economists argued. Japan, Singapore, Thailand, and other Asian economies relied more, proportionately, on imported energy than the United States, and yet their economies had thrived overall and had produced trade surpluses. Yes, reducing oil imports could meaningfully and helpfully reduce America's trade deficit and thereby its total debts, but to blame oil for America's unbalanced economy and its struggles in global economic competition was specious. Energy independence would reduce or eliminate the need for American military intervention and defense spending in the unstable Middle East. America's Middle East policies were constructed to defend Israel, check radical regimes such as Iran's and Saddam Hussein's Iraq, and keep global sea lanes open for all commerce to strengthen the world economy. In any event, U.S. defense spending as a percentage of national wealth was not badly out of line by historical standards. Energy independence would break the resource curse cycle by which American dollars financed hostile regimes in Venezuela, Iran, and elsewhere, and by which it encouraged the formation of corrupt authoritarian regimes in poor countries such as Chad, Nigeria, and Equatorial Guinea. In the future of the world's energy economy lies in rising consumption in China, India, and other developing economies. Their purchases would only replace America's. A technological revolution in which all oil consumption was rapidly displaced worldwide was unrealistic, given the pace of economic growth taking place in poorer countries and their thirst for energy. Energy independence would free the United States from the threat of coercive supply disruption by hostile countries, such as occurred twice during the 1970s. ExxonMobil's own private wargaming scenarios show that such threats were not realistic, particularly given the security of supply to the United States from Canada, Mexico, and Africa. In any event, the Strategic Petroleum Reserve had been constructed to manage any short-term dislocations, to buy time for more decisive interventions, in the worst case. Rapid adoption of clean energy would reduce the threat of climate change. Even if global warming threatened the United States, and ExxonMobil remained unconvinced about the certainty and magnitude of the threat, it did not warrant costly government intervention, which would impede economic growth and threaten jobs, particularly if the policy response did not include rising economies such as China and India, whose emissions were greater than those of the United States. To Tillerson and other ExxonMobil executives, Bush's speech signaled how flawed and politicized American energy policy had become. If Tillerson and his management committee could write their own foreign and energy policy for the United States, it would involve, first, an acceptance of the liquidity and interconnectedness of global oil markets, and an end to fantasies about national independence from those markets, and second, a recognition that carbon-based fuels would be central to the energy economy for decades, even if a significant tax on carbon was imposed eventually to address the risks of global warming. From those premises, ExxonMobil's executives would construct a deliberate country-by-country strategy to maximize oil and gas supply through free market competition and to enforce the sanctity of commercial contracts to support that effort. Such a strategy, if carried out with discipline and pragmatism, might ultimately provide the United States with adequate energy security, as Tillerson put it, as opposed to energy independence. This was ExxonMobil's corporate foreign policy. It frustrated Tillerson that he could not persuade even the relatively oil-educated Bush administration to adopt it, and worse, that the president, during his second term, worn down by Iraq, seemed to be drifting away from ExxonMobil's policy vision altogether.